If they were blown through, the chances of beating back to windward toward the island would be virtually non-existent. Nevertheless, Greenstreet and Macklin admitted frankly to one another that very likely the Docker had already been driven out to sea. The Docker's compass had been smashed some time earlier, and all that remained to steer by was Worsley's little silver pocket compass. The two men spread the tent cover over their heads, and Macklin struck matches while Greenstreet tried to read the compass. But even under the shelter of the canvas, the wind snuffed out the matches almost as soon as they were lit. Macklin then took his knife and split the individual match heads to make them flare long enough so that Greenstreet could see the compass. Every few minutes they ducked under the tent cloth and took a reading, hoping to hold the Docker on a southwest course so that at least she would not be blown farther out to sea. As they seemed on the very brink of exhaustion, and as the wind screamed to new heights, the palest hint of light showed in the eastern sky and began to brighten, very slowly. There was no telling how long it took to get light enough to see, but it was a long, long time. Even their raging thirst after 48 hours without water was forgotten as they waited for the sun to reveal their fate. Secretly, each man tried to prepare himself for the shock of seeing only an empty sea, or at best, a distant island far away to windward and unreachable. Gradually, the surface of the sea became discernible. And there, dead ahead, were the enormous grey-brown cliffs of Elephant Island, rising out of the mists, sheer from the water, high above the boat, and less than a mile away. The distance seemed no more than a few hundred yards. There was no great joy in that moment, only a feeling of astonishment, which soon gave way to a sense of tremendous relief. Just then, without an instant's warning, offshore gusts of wind swept down off the cliffs, striking the surface of the sea at perhaps 100 miles an hour. A moment later, a wall of water, as high as the boat, rolled toward the Docker. Greenstreet shouted to drop the sail. The oars were hurriedly put out, and they pulled head-on into the blasts that shrieked down off the mountaintops. Somehow, they managed to hold the Docker's head up into it, but the exertion required them to put forth strength they no longer really had. Looking forward, they saw a new wave, possibly 6 feet high, bearing down upon them. Somebody shouted to wake up Worsley, and MacLeod shook him violently, trying to rouse him. But Worsley was like a dead man, sprawled over the cases of stores midships, with the soaking wet tent cloth spread over him. MacLeod shook him again, and when Worsley failed to stir, MacLeod kicked him, again and again. Finally, Worsley opened his eyes. He sat up, and instantly he realized what was happening. "For God's sake!" he shouted. "Get her around! Get her away from it! Hoist the sail!" Greenstreet put the tiller over, and the men struggled feverishly to raise the sail. She had just caught the wind when the first wave hit them and rolled over the stern. Greenstreet was almost knocked off his seat. A moment later, the second wave engulfed them. The Docker, half filled with water, slumped under the burden and lost most of her headway. Everything else was forgotten. The men seized the first thing that came to hand and began to bail. They threw the water over the side with mugs, hats, even their cupped bare hands. Gradually, they got the Docker emptied out. Worsley took the tiller and turned north to run before the gale, with the seas pursuing the boat from astern. He guided her close inshore, just under the lofty glaciers fringing the island. Pieces of ice floated amongst the waves, and the men leaned over the sides as the boat drove past and scooped them up with their hands. A moment later, they were chewing and sucking greedily, and the delicious water was running down their throats. Chapter 5. Throughout the night, Shackleton, on board the Caird, had kept watch for the Docker, and as the hours passed, his anxiety mounted. He had faith in Worsley's seamanship, but such a night demanded something more than skill. However, there was more than enough to keep him occupied with the Caird. Wilde remained at the tiller, and as the southwest gale increased, he held them on a course as nearly into the wind as possible, so that they wouldn't be blown past the island. Spray burst over the bow and swept across the dark forms of the men huddled in the bottom of the boat. Hussey tried tending the line to the mainsail, but several times the wind tore it from his grasp, and Vincent had to take over for him. On board the Wills, towed astern of the Caird, conditions were even more miserable. The pain in Hudson's side had become almost intolerable, and it was more than he could bear to stay at the tiller. Tom Crean took over for him, and occasionally Billy Bakewell had a turn at steering. Rickenson, a slight individual, seemed on the point of collapse, and sat by himself off to one side. Howe and Stevenson, when they weren't bailing, clung to one another seeking to generate some bit of warmth between their bodies. The bow of the Wills plunged into almost every sea, so that the men sat knee-deep in water. Ironically, this was almost comfort, for the water was warmer than the air. Blackborough's feet were long since beyond the point of hurting. He never complained, though he knew that it was only a matter of time until gangrene set in. Even if he lived, it seemed unlikely that this youngster, who had stowed away a year and a half before, would ever walk again. Once during the night, Shackleton called to him in an attempt to raise his spirits.
"Blackborough!"
he shouted in the darkness.
"Here, sir,"
Blackborough replied.
"We shall be on Elephant Island tomorrow," Shackleton yelled. "No one has ever landed there before, and you'll be the first ashore."
Blackborough did not answer. Shackleton sat in the stern of the Caird alongside Wilde, with his hand on the line between them and the Wills. Before dark he had instructed Hudson that if the Wills got adrift, he was to make for land to leeward, probably Clarence Island, and wait there until a rescue boat could be sent to pick up the men. But the order had been merely a routine pretense. Shackleton knew that if the Wills broke loose, she would never be seen again. And now, as he sat in the stern, he could feel the Wills seize up on the towline as she rose unwillingly to each wave. Looking back, he could just see her in the darkness. Several times the line went slack, and she disappeared from sight, only to reappear suddenly, outlined against the whiteness of a breaking wave. When at last the first grey tinge of dawn appeared, the Wills, by some marvellous caprice of luck, was still doggedly astern of the Caird. And there was land, too, looming on top of them off the port bow, great black headlands appearing through the mists, scarcely a quarter mile away. Immediately Shackleton ordered them to put about and head west across the wind, and in the space of 15 minutes, possibly less, the wind suddenly eased off. They had passed the northeast tip of the island, and they were under the lee of the land at last. They held to a westerly course, with the hulking cliffs and glaciers rearing up alongside them. Dominican gulls screamed in flight along the rock faces that rose sheer from the water, great masses of volcanic formations against whose sides the seas broke furiously. But there was no sign of a landing place, not even the smallest cove or beach. There was ice, though. Large pieces of glaciers that had tumbled into the water floated on the surface. The men snatched up small chunks and thrust them into their mouths. For nearly an hour they searched the shoreline for a foothold, however small. Then somebody spied a tiny shingled beach, half hidden behind a chain of rocks. Shackleton stood up on one of the seats and saw that it was a treacherous place. He hesitated for a moment, then ordered the boats to make for it. When they were 1,000 yards off, Shackleton signalled the Wills to come alongside and take him on board. Of the two boats, she had the shallower draught, and Shackleton wanted to approach the beach in her first to see if the Caird could negotiate the seething channel between the rocks. At that exact moment, the docker was driving westward along the coast, looking for a place to land. Since sunrise, by Worsley's estimate, they had gone 14 miles, past point after point, without seeing a single sight fit to beach the boat on. During all that distance, there had been not a glimpse of the other two boats, and it was now almost 9:30. The docker's crew were sure that they alone had survived the night.
"Poor blighters," Greenstreet whispered to Macklin. "They are gone."
Then they rounded a tiny spit of land And there, dead ahead, were the masts of the Caird and Wills bobbing in the backwash from the breakers. By some incredible coincidence, the docker's inability to find a suitable place to land had reunited her with the rest of the party. Had there been a haven somewhere in those 14 miles behind her, the two groups might now have been miles apart, each assuming the other had been lost. The men aboard the docker gave 3 hoarse cheers to their shipmates, but the noise of the breakers drowned them out. A few minutes later, their sail was sighted from the Caird, and just then Shackleton himself looked up and saw the docker bearing down upon them. By then the Wills was close inshore. A shallow reef lay across the opening, and heavy rollers foamed over it. Shackleton waited for his moment, then gave the order to pull, and the Wills rolled safely over the reef. With the next wave, her bow ground against the shore. Shackleton, remembering his promise, urged Blackborough to jump ashore. But the lad failed to move. He seemed not to comprehend what Shackleton was saying. Impatiently, Shackleton took hold of him and lifted him over the side. Blackborough dropped to his hands and knees, then rolled over and sat down with the surf surging around him. "Get up," Shackleton ordered. Blackborough looked up.
"I can't, sir," he replied.
Shackleton suddenly remembered Blackborough's feet. In the excitement of the landing, he had forgotten, and he felt ashamed. Howe and Bakewell jumped overboard and pulled Blackborough farther up the beach. The stores were rapidly unloaded, and the Wills was rowed out to the docker. Stores and men were transferred and ferried ashore. Then the Caird was unloaded enough so she could negotiate the reef. As the boats were being pulled to safety, Rickinson suddenly turned pale and a minute later collapsed of a heart attack. Greenstreet's frost-bitten feet would hardly support him, and he hobbled ashore and lay down alongside of Blackborough. Hudson pulled himself through the surf, then sank down on the beach. Stevenson, a vacant expression on his face, was helped ashore out of reach of the water. They were on land. It was the merest handhold, 100 feet wide and 50 feet deep, a meager grip on a savage coast exposed to the full fury of the sub-Antarctic Ocean. But no matter. They were on land. For the first time in 497 days, they were on land. Solid, unsinkable, immovable, blessed land. Part 5. Chapter 1. Many of the men half stumbled about aimlessly, scuffling their feet in the pebbles or bending down to pick up a handful of rocks. Some even dropped full length to the ground to feel its sublime solidity beneath them. For a time, a few men simply sat down, shivering uncontrollably and mumbling gibberish to themselves. Just then, the sun came out. In its light, their faces showed dead white from exhaustion and frostbite, and from being continually soaked with water. The circles around their eyes were so deep their eyes seemed to have sunk slightly into their heads. Green readied some milk as quickly as he could, and each man's mug was filled. They drank it almost boiling hot, and its heat spread through their bodies, settling their nerves to tingling as if their blood had suddenly been thawed and begun to flow again. From where they stood around the blubber stove, the cliffs of their side of the island were less than 15 yards away. They rose straight up, 800 feet into the air, levelled off for a bit, then climbed skyward again to a height of perhaps 2,500 feet. But their little niche of gravel was relatively thick with life. A land of fatness, Antarctically speaking, James noted. Farther down the beach, 10 seals lay basking in the sun a short distance from the water. There was also a small rookery of ringed penguins high up on a rock to one side, and periodically little bands of gentoo penguins waddled up out of the water to survey these strange creatures who had come in from the sea. There were birds, too, skua gulls, paddies, cormorants, and cape pigeons. Shackleton stood in the center of the group. He had removed his helmet and his long, uncut hair hung down over his forehead. His shoulders were bent with care,